Melissa Idris. You're watching The Future is Female, the show where we find the extraordinary in every woman. Today on the show, I have joining me Deborah Henry. She is Miss Malaysia World 2007, also Miss Universe Malaysia for 2011. But right now, she's a co-founder of the non-profit Fuji. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's
lovely to have you here. I am so curious to know more about your work with Fuji because you work with refugee children and you have a social enterprise, you have a school that that looks at the education for refugee children. Can you tell us a little bit more about your work with Fuji?
Yeah, so, you know, it's really started in my teenage years. It wasn't something a lot of people go, oh, you're a beauty queen. You must love to do charity work, right? You know, world peace and all that jazz. It actually started for me when I was, I think I was 15. I remember feeling very strongly about injustice, about greed. I remember sitting with my grandfather and going, you know, why are there so many people who are suffering in this world that don't have food and people go to war and fight and kill each other? Very innocent, perhaps naive questions.
Idealist.
Yes, I was very much an idealist. A little bit more realist now. So my interest was there and it grew over the years. And then I started modeling when I was 15, 16. Mm. So I wanted to pursue that. I moved to London to model, but the commitment I made to my parents was I have to go to university, get my degree. And so when it came to thinking of what I wanted to study, the thing that really stuck with me was this topic, right? And so I ended up studying political science and economics and came back to Malaysia and then, you know, joined a beauty pageant. So it's always been like a dance in tandem.
Does it feel like one was a trade-off to the other, that, you know, going into the world of beauty modeling was a trade-off for the activism, for being taken seriously with the activism, or was it the opposite? Did it give you a platform to talk about the issues that you so clearly champion?
A bit of both, actually. I mean, overwhelmingly a positive, but of course it's being taken, exactly, you hit the nail on the head, it's being taken seriously. And so for me, growing up, it was very much, I'm a model. Yes, I put on clothes and magazines and fashion shows and on television. I'm a TV host as well. But you're so known in that world when you try to be taken seriously and be serious in a very different world. It's kind of like, oh, this is like the celebrity perspective.
Right. Have you had the comment that it is performative activism, that, you know, people take it as superficial, or
especially nowadays because of all the Instagram influencers and, you know, it's all about putting up this thing on your Instagram and that means you're taking a stand, and it's like there's a lot more in life than just an Instagram post, right?
So what was that for you, taking a stand? What did that mean for you, especially with Fuji?
So it meant, you know, when I graduated, I came back to Malaysia. Very soon after I won Miss World Malaysia in the 2007. And it's, with that title, obviously, world peace, doing something good is a beauty with a purpose, is a very strong focus. And so I was already volunteering, I was already getting my hands dirty, so to speak. And I think it's super important that if you want to do work like this, you have to experience it on the ground. Okay. You can't sit in a fancy schmancy office and just write papers. Mm-hmm. So really being on the ground, understanding the issues. I worked with World Vision, which is an international humanitarian organization, and traveled the world a lot of places with them. So I got a lot more firsthand experience, which I think is important. And soon after that, I set up Fuji. And that was essentially, I did some work for UNHCR in Malaysia, and I visited 4 refugee families. Mm. And it was really heartbreaking because my mum's a teacher, and so I understand the value of an education growing up, and I was very privileged to be able to get it. And I visited these families and the kids were not in school.
So what is the main objective of Fuji? Is it to help refugees integrate, to empower them? What exactly is it?
I think it's essentially for the refugee community and vulnerable communities in Malaysia who don't have identification that is recognized in a way that allows them access to education opportunities and to job opportunities. Okay. And seeing a population that is so capable, they have so much to contribute, they have dreams, they have hopes. They didn't ask for this. They didn't ask for wars in their country, whether it's Yemen or Syria or Palestine or Myanmar, the Rohingya community, they didn't ask for this, and it's forced upon them. And so they're not given really a choice. We would all do the same thing, protect our families, protect our children. It's a very human thing. It's really that, for me, it's seeing these kids be able to go to school, to learn, to know that when he turns 18 or she turns 18, that they have They have what it takes. People have invested in them. People have told them, you have value, you matter, and that they can then be able to build a successful and meaningful life for themselves.
How does your nonprofit help them do that, given, you know, there are so many restrictions placed on them, particularly if they don't have the UNHCR accreditation, the card, they're not carrying the card. How do you go about helping them build a life in Malaysia, in a country that doesn't recognize them, doesn't give them the right to work or the right to go to school?
Yeah, it is challenging, because I've been doing this for over 10 years now, and there's so much that we could do. There are people, there are companies, there are individuals, there are organizations that want to do so much, not just say for refugees, for people who are in need, for the vulnerable, and they can't because of certain restrictions. And so there are massive hurdles that we face, but we're always creative and innovative, and always focusing on the hope in the future. But what we do is we essentially provide an education. So we run a school called Fuji School. It's our education arm, and we teach children from the ages of 4 all the way up to about 20. And then we look at what's next. Would you like to try to get a college university certificate? Would you like to maybe get an internship or learn some skills, vocational skills? And we try and connect the dots for these youth to help them think of a future. It's crazy, because so many of these kids, you meet them and you talk to them and they cannot see a future. Imagine that, like when they look ahead in their lives, it's dark. And what we try to get them to do is to actually start opening, letting the light in, and actually start seeing dreams, seeing possibilities.
So it's more than just an education. It's also about life skills.
Way more. It's about building the intrinsic value, self-worth, self-value, the confidence in a kid, and grit. We talk about grit and resilience in life, and there's so many, it's been a buzzword, of course, for many years, but it's not just about the smarts and saying 2 + 2 = 4. Yes, I'm great at math. It's having that resilience to push through, because life is hard. And we, you know, coming out of with this pandemic we've been going through, COVID-19, you know, it's hard, and we've all been facing challenges. And you need that resilience to be able to push through, the fighting spirit.
But particularly harder, I mean, it's hard for us, but particularly harder for the marginalized, for the vulnerable.
Absolutely.
And often quite invisible.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah. So, okay, we're going to take a quick break, Deborah, but we'll come back and continue this conversation right here on The Future's Female. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Future's Female. I'm speaking to Deborah Henry tonight. She's the former Miss Malaysia World 2007, also the Miss Universe Malaysia 2011.
I know, it's a tongue twister.
I get them confused, the titles. But right now you're working with Fuji, the nonprofit, working with refugees. I wanted to ask you, so you said that, you know, you've been working, it's been more than 10 years since you've been involved in this, and you've also, it's kind of gone back to your past that you've been on the ground working with, you know, all these organizations. Talk to me a little bit about what you learned about refugees in Malaysia specifically that perhaps you didn't know when you first started 10 years ago. You started Fuji 10 years ago.
Yeah, just to quickly jump back to a few years ago, I actually had the opportunity to go to Lebanon with World Vision, and I actually visited a group of Syrian refugees who had crossed over the border and were living just in this Bekaa Valley, like pretty much a desert region. And that has been, and I've traveled a lot, I've seen a lot, and that was the most heartbreaking thing I've pretty much ever witnessed. It broke, and it takes a lot to get to me, because I, like I said, I've traveled and seen so much. But that was really one of the most heartbreaking. So it really breaks my heart when I read the stuff I read online, sometimes by netizens, citizens, whatever you call them.
The xenophobia, the hate
speech. It's really painful.
I have to admit, I mean, and I'm sure you've noticed too, the rise of this type of hate speech online.
Yeah, exactly. It's really sad, because I really don't think, I've been doing this for 10 years. I'm on the ground. I talk to Malaysians. I talk to refugees. I've been, even during this pandemic, delivering a lot of food aid to various communities, migrant communities, the B40. And I speak to people. Yes, there is a need. We all need more. But it isn't this massive threat of some foreign person or some other being, it's us and them, them right. coming to take from us, okay. and them, and because they're going to take from us, we're not going to have enough.
I like that you brought up this otherness, right? And I was wondering whether you think there are limits to our humanitarianism, whether in times of crises like the pandemic,
yes.
when we are hungry or scared or tired or economically vulnerable, whether there is a limit to our compassion and our ability to take care of others. And, you know, have you seen that in your work?
I've seen the overwhelming outpouring of financial support and otherwise from individuals, I won't even say Malaysians, foreigners, whoever, whatever, mm. that stood up and gave so much without asking any questions because they wanted to make sure that nobody during this time went to bed on an empty stomach, yeah. that people had food on their tables, and people felt that. And that was like, it makes my hair stand today talking about it. That was incredible humanity at its finest. But it's also, it's a very thin line because when you feed fear, when you feed fear and you feed ignorance or a lack of knowledge, when you feed that, it gets bigger. And when people already are in a situation where they don't know, mm. whether it's fear of their personal situations or the country, the economy, the political situation, the global situation, and you feed into that, whoever you may be, that is where you're going to see changes. And that I really think that's where a lot of the xenophobic sentiments have come from.
Well, you have, you speak to a lot of refugees, I'm sure, in the refugee community. How are they digesting this, particularly the kind of ramping up of the xenophobia
yeah.
in recent weeks?
I mean, I think on an individual level, from if you talk to youth and mums, they are scared to let their kids out of the house. Oh. They don't, even to come to school. We've started back a little bit at school now. And, you know, am I going to get in trouble? Is someone going to come after me? There's a lot of that fear.
There's real fear.
Yes, there really is fear. And, like, you know, apart from doing the necessary, people just want to stay home. Mm-hmm. That is something that's a huge concern. And I think a little bit of confusion as to, like, am I protected, or can I be detained, or what's the deal? And I think there's a lot of information and buzz going around, and people are fearful in that respect.
Okay. So what are the rights? What are their rights? When you talk to the refugee community that you have access to, what do you tell them about what rights they have?
Well, we say you have your UNHCR card, as you pointed out earlier, and that does offer you a degree of protection, mm-hmm. That, you know, you are under the protection of UNHCR
yes.
agency in Malaysia, and that our government respects that mm-hmm. and acknowledges that. So, you know, they do have to carry that with them at all times and show that to authorities.
Okay. What about the COVID response? I mean, you know, a large part of the public health response mm-hmm. to COVID was targeted to a citizen. So, you know, the communication was all in Malay and in English. Was the refugee community
yes.
taken into consideration?
So that's where a lot of our, you know, we're in a couple of WhatsApp group chats, and that's where all of the nonprofits and organizations that work with the various uh-huh. communities. We're very, very fast to creating content in all the local languages, because we all recognize that everyone needs access, whether you are considered to be undocumented mm. or otherwise, you need access to
yes.
this life-saving information. And because it's a shared, it's our shared responsibility and shared humanity,
yeah.
you know. This funny thing with drawing lines and boundaries and borders, when you have issues like climate change and even this, issues don't respect those lines and boundaries. So that's where each individual has to be very responsible. And that's where you realize we're all in this together in a very real sense. We talk about being in the same storm. We're in different boats. Some boats are luxury yachts. Some are smaller sampans. Mm. So we all experience it very differently, but we're in the same storm.
How do you respond to people who, you know, more often than not, you think that they share your worldview. You think that they are also sympathetic to the plight of the marginalized, but sometimes are not, and that kind of intolerance sometimes surprises me in people that I don't
yeah,
expect to
had,
see it in.
I was actually interviewed by a media a month or so ago, and I read a lot of the comments made by people, and I was really shocked because in over 10 years in doing this, I obviously give a lot of interviews, and I've never seen such language being used.
Is it this climate, or is it?
I think it's always kind of been there. I think it's
okay.
also a sense of now people feeling very much. That they can say it out loud.
Okay.
I think that's right. and they feel, because there was this whole wave of it and Serge saying, you know, leave our country, get out, you don't follow our values, you're not a good whatever person, you know, there's not enough for us, so go back to where you came from. You have a home,
are
ours.
Are these voices on the periphery, you think, Deborah? Or are they just loud voices on the periphery
I
think marginal voices, or are
yeah,
they the
I think
majority?
Some of them are voices are actually perhaps just making noise, and maybe they just come from a place of, we don't want anyone here, Malaysia is for us. How do you argue with that? But a point to make is that I think there are some legit concerns, because I actually reached out to a few of these people who made very strong comments on my Instagram. And I was like, I want to understand this a little bit better.
Yes.
So I reached out to them and I asked them. Only a few responded. And they had very harsh comments on the post. And so I asked them, like, what's actually going on? So they responded and they were like, there are communities that, you know, in certain areas and some in where we live that have not been able to integrate very well. So this comes back to a matter of integration. And history has shown us, from New York to any part of the world, when you have new communities come together, there's always a little bit of a struggle, perhaps, a friction in the integration process, because there is a responsibility on the incoming community to also understand the local ways and cultures. So it's really rights and responsibilities. It's a dance. It's a dance of, like, as Malaysians, recognizing these people are coming here for a very specific reason to protect themselves, and what role can we play? Mm-hmm. But also to the refugees coming here, it's also responsibility on them to learn about our country.
Does Fuji help in that integration?
We do, we do. We actually spend a lot of time, especially with our children, the students in the school, and also the parents. In light of all of this going on, we've actually decided to work on a integration workshop. So we're actually working on it now. We're going to pilot it in our community very soon. Mm-hmm. So recognizing it's not, I don't want to just sit here and go like, oh, you guys are talking rubbish and you're terrible people. It's listening.
Understanding
we need
why.
To understand and listen. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, a problem. The problem is intolerance. The problem is lack of respect. I don't have to agree with you, but I sure should listen to you and respect your opinions. You know, and so if we can build that respect, that tolerance, where two people can sit here and talk without throwing things at each other and being really rude, yes. then we can both leave here more knowledge, more empowered.
To be open to listening.
And to be open. And that's the only way you can conflict resolution. That's the only way you can move forward. It's not to say that this guy came to my village and he did something wrong and I didn't like it and he offended me and therefore get out. There is a solution and we can work on that.
Right. Another quick break and we'll come back and continue this conversation. Stay tuned. Let's continue our conversation with Deborah Henry on The Future's Female. Deborah, last year, I think at the end of last year, you moderated the talk with Michelle Obama and Julia Roberts when they were in town. That was the Leaders Asia Pacific, that inaugural, they had a conference here in KL. And you were the moderator. And
I know.
How was that? Was wonderful. So talk to me about that experience, particularly because Michelle Obama and Julia Roberts are very vocal about women empowerment, about leadership. What was that experience like?
I mean, it was amazing. I think for me, going back to what we talked about earlier, you know, being taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the ultimate, like, sort of like stamp of like approval. Not that I needed one, but...
Yes, it was an acknowledgement of your work in this...
Because specifically why they actually asked me to moderate the discussion was because of the work I'm doing with Fuji. I'm in it. Mm. And then obviously my experience as a host, as a moderator. So two worlds coming together really
wonderful.
Well. But also it was an honor to be able to share the stage. It was essentially three women sitting on the stage sharing about their lives. And to say that we're not all that different.
Okay.
We all grew up with the same struggles. We all grew up with the same misconceptions, biases. Yes, some of us are more famous than the other, but the struggles are really the same as women. And I think that's what Michelle Obama really, she has such an amazing aura and she really was able to tap into that.
Right.
And I think people, you really leave knowing that if this woman could do it, this African-American woman who grew up poor with little opportunity, but studied hard, worked hard, and could get into, I think she went to Princeton and then Harvard, and then became First Lady.
So
she's got such a huge accomplishment list before even First Lady.
Well, these names are so, you know, they're kind of star-studded names. It feels really kind of out of our reach. Were they real with you? Did you feel a connection? What kind of stories did they share with you and the audience that kind of click that registered for you?
I mean, I think one of the big ones was Michelle Obama talked about imposter syndrome. And then Julia Roberts was sort of like, what is that? And a lot of people actually didn't know what it was. And then Michelle said, it's when you think that you don't belong. So you think when you sit at this table, you're having to fake it.
I think a lot of women feel that, and young girls as well.
Exactly. Where it's either the color of your skin, it's your faith, it's your nationality, it's your status. undocumented or otherwise, it's being a woman. Mm. And you sit there and you think, oh gosh, who am I to be here? And then all of a sudden you realize, hang on a minute, I have every right to be here. I have what it takes to be here and to believe in yourself in a real way. Mm. And I think the crowd, people really connected with that message. And she went through that for a long, long time until she went, hang on a minute. So and Julia was like, you know what, actually, I've kind of felt that a little bit as well. So have I. Mm. And so it's really, we found common points where you sit and you really talk and you show a keen interest to listen to someone and learn from them.
Right.
You find that, oh my God, we're not so different.
And what are some of the things that they're championing? I know Michelle Obama uses education as a tool for empowerment, very much like what you're doing with Fuji School.
Yes.
What were the things that were talked about, the issues that were championed apart from women's empowerment that perhaps we could learn from?
Well, I think female empowerment, she has a girls initiative. She also believes strongly in, and this is why I think the reason for the Obama Foundation, to some degree, was really, you cannot always expect your leaders, the politicians, the people in positions of power, to do everything for you. It is upon us as individuals. Mm-hmm. And so the youth of today have so much power, we have access to technology, resources, we have everything it takes. And at our fingertips, and we're so intuitive with gadgets and that. We just need the will and that focus. And so it's really investing in the youth of our world in all countries, from people from all walks of life, and getting them to be the change makers in their lives and their communities.
What about you, Deborah? What does empowerment mean for you?
Empowerment is firstly access to opportunities for you to be able to invest in yourself, to be better, to believe in yourself. It's a confidence at the end of the day that you have what it takes within you to be able to share that with the world, to achieve, to go out there, and to conquer your dreams. Mm. And it comes down to a word that really resonates with me is choice. Empowerment is choice, ultimately. It's that you sit here today because you choose to, as a woman, as a Malaysian woman, and same with me. And so for me, my struggle is that every child that I work with, boy, girl, Malaysian, non-Malaysian, is able to have the choice to go to school, the choice to, if they choose university, college, to get a skill, to get a job, to be able to have a chance at achieving their dreams. And that's it. And then if you choose to do what you want with that, that's up to you.
So bearing that in mind, how does success with your work with Fuji, what does success look like to you? How do you know you've achieved what you want to achieve with Fuji? What does that look like?
it's an ongoing process,
sure.
To be honest. There isn't quite an answer, but for me, it's the success I see, and it's in little ways every day, is a student who's gotten resettled to Canada and to get feedback that they've graduated from university, or that 5 years ago they were at Fuji and now they're graduates and they've got jobs and they finished high school and they've done
well. Have there been a lot of those stories?
Absolutely. Some of my former students send me their graduation pictures. Oh. And it, like, that's the ultimate, to know that, like, we played a role in someone's life. And it's so important to remember that education is generational. Nelson Mandela said that education is the most powerful weapon you can use to change the world. We invest so much of our time and resources into military defense, into so many other sectors. But if you want to really look at change, it starts with an education. It starts with a four-year-old in kindergarten. It starts with changing the mindsets of our next generation. Mm-hmm. And the effects of that will be monumental and immeasurable, really, and generational.
So it's been more than 10 years. What else do you have planned for Fuji?
So we've got FujiLa. That's the business arm of
the
nonprofit.
Yes. Yeah, that feeds back into the school.
Yes, it does.
It?
Okay. So it's a kind of a, we wanted to be a little bit more innovative in how we look at fundraising, not relying on receiving funds all the time. So it's a fashion and lifestyle business. We make earrings like this and other fashion accessories. We collaborate with a lot of local partners. It's about, I think, in creating beautiful products that people can buy, they also get to support a good cause, educate kids, and I think more and more people are aware, and
right.
So that's something that's very important.
Yes, they vote with their wallets, right? They
Precisely.
Vote for the kind of world they want with their wallets.
You get, and I think more and more people now, especially coming out of this COVID-19 pandemic, mm-hmm. it's you know, your dollars matter and where you put them matter. And so you have a lot of power. Coming back to this whole power thing, as individuals, we have a lot of power. If we're armed with knowledge, we can then choose how we want to use our power for the greater good, and not just Malaysians, but everyone, humanity, because we're, you know, it's a shared humanity. Yeah. If you're going to suffer, I'm probably going to suffer too at some point. So we're very interconnected. And I think for me coming out of this, it's that realization. We're all so much alike.
Everything impacts us. Yes, we are. We're all alike.
We're more alike than we think. We're you know, blood runs through our veins. We feel the same emotions, happiness, sadness, tragedy, and family matters. And I think if humanity can dig into that a little bit deeper,
find more common things in common, right?
Don't let fear drive you.
Deborah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you. That's all the time we have on this episode of The Future is Female. I will be back with you same time next week. Thank you so much for watching. Good night.